welcome back to another exciting episode of Talks Talk. This is Matt Zuckerman, a toxicology fellow at the UMass Division of Toxicology. Thank you for joining me again. For those of you that are listening to your first show, you might want to go one show further back. This show is going to be a second part of a two-part series where we had a chance to interview the founders and directors of the Arrowhead Center and Arrowhead website, Earth and Fire Arrowhead. And that interview was so in-depth and was such a lengthy piece that we decided to chop it into digestible two parts. So you might want to hear the first part before you hear the second part. Although, if this is all you've got, it should still all make sense. And just a reminder, you can check us out on the web at our website, toxtalk.org, toxtalk.org, or you can follow more of our goings-on at our Facebook page or our Twitter feed at ToxTalk. And without further ado, here is the second part of that interview.
Something that somebody else asked, and I feel like something that's definitely becoming more relevant, is the advocacy of the medicalization of marijuana. And we've actually had some discussion about that on the show. And it seems like there's definitely an advocate group that sees a medical use for it and sees it beneficial. It seems like there's also a certain undertone of kind of what we've been talking about dangerous drugs and how dangerous drugs are, and some people who just feel like it should be legal. And one of the pathways to broadening access is through medicalization.
Sure. Right. I mean, there's no question that some portion of the medicalization of cannabis is a camel's nose under the tent attempt to try to break through what has been a series of irrational policies.
But to say that medical cannabis is a camel's nose under the tent should not be taken to mean that medical use of cannabis is not also a legitimate issue.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think in a lot of ways, when in 1996, when Proposition 215 passed in California, which semi-legalized the medical use of cannabis, I actually thought that if the DEA and the Clinton administration at the time had actually taken that up as a good idea rather than a bad idea for their policy positions, and basically turn pot into grandma's medicine, right? If they sort of actually go after making it associating cannabis with boring old sick people, right? That they might have actually achieved their policy aims, stated policy aims, more than
reducing young people.
So the way to get young people to avoid something is to make it uncool and associated with their grandparents.
Right.
Oh, that's an idea.
You know, make it available in really boring packages only, right? And, you know,
Oh, no, absolutely, yeah. Well, and I think on some level having a sense of humor with some of this is important because you get unintended consequences. I mean, I find it interesting just from a toxicologic perspective because regardless of the medical benefits or not benefits of the substance, the fact that it's sort of passed independent of the traditional means of evaluating medicinals and now has its own sort of special status. And then each state that passes it sort of has to come up with almost kind of like a shadow dispensary system in an alternative option to its pharmacies, I think demonstrates that we're sort of stretching things a little bit in order to get it out there. But that's my personal opinion. I can't really say that that's and then it seems like part of this discussion, too, we've talked about the unintended effects of legislation and prohibition of drugs and kind of the spurring on of new and more powerful substances. So do you feel like we're going to be seeing a lot more of these new drugs? And it seems like you're almost saying like the innovation is a bad thing.
I don't think the innovation is a bad thing, but I think that the innovation and speed with which a new untested drug hits the streets and is using 17-year-olds as the guinea pigs, it could be optimized.
Right. I mean, I think
that could be a little better.
You have to ask the question of sort of what is the population, what's the demographics of the people who are most likely to use new, unknown, sort of gray market, not quite illegal drugs? And the answer to that is, at this point, sort of 16 to 25-year-olds. And so you've designed a set of policies where the result is to have basically new drugs being tested in the wild on young people. And
and primarily that's because they want to be using something that's not illegal.
Right.
Not because they all have a dying need to be the first person to try a new drug and be cool because of it.
Right. There's no question that there are some small number of people. I think it's a fairly small number of people who are really interested in being kind of the
cutting edge tester.
Extreme use.
Groundbreaking.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Well, and, you know, it's the experimenters. I mean, there's an experimental component,
explorer
component to a lot of the use of this kind of psychedelic and pathogen range. But I think it seems likely, and this is completely speculative, I'm not stating this as fact, but that if there were a standard set of socially disapproved but
available at known identity and known quantity.
And that you won't lose your college loan and you won't go to
prison. If LSD, MDMA, and psilocybin mushrooms and cannabis were available
in
known doses,
right.
even if illegal, were readily available, more readily available, I think less people would be trying synthetic cannabinoids,
2-5-I
and BOMA and MDPV, you know.
Right, 4-MeO-PCP, right? I mean, there's just sort of this...
And I think you asked at the beginning of that sentence, do we think that it's going to continue to be new drugs? I think the answer, our current theory is yes.
It seems to me more like we're at the beginning of a phase rather than the end of a phase. There seem to be choices that we're involved on the information side. We believe that at least for a while there needs to be a substantial change in the way that information is managed, distributed, collected, and allow people to allow some new equilibrium to be set around the way that people relate to these things. I mean, we think that one of the kind of the fundamental issues is that for the last, let's call it 100 years, for this kind of this policy mindset around prohibition, where, I mean, not to exaggerate, there was, you know, the Drug-Free Millennium Act was proposed in the Senate in 1999, right? The idea that there would be kind of like this sort of...
If we just get the policies just right, then we can stop all the recreational use of drugs that happen.
And yet, the kind of the more rational kind of view is that people who are sane, educated, and stable make sane, educated, and stable choices in most cases, right? People who have a good life don't want to ruin their life. And so, sure, people will make experimental choices and will try out new things and will make bad choices or will...
And some people will be hurt.
And some people will be hurt. And there's no future of a world where that will not be happening, where people will not be dying from making bad choices or being exposed to bad drugs.
And so we keep trying to publish some information.
Better living through better information. And so, like, actually, so, I mean, I don't know what your annual budget is. I know that you get a variety of support through various sources that you've worked on, and it seems like it's got to be a hard thing to do, and I'm sure that you face some challenges. If you had a huge cash infusion, what would you be doing differently or better?
I think that we would be doing very similar work to what we're doing, but we would be doing it more comprehensively. One of the visualizations that we have often described is our job is a little bit like standing under a waterfall, trying to catch the best bits with a little tin cup. There's a lot of information that could be better synthesized and analyzed and published that we think would continue to help develop the understanding of psychoactive drugs, their use, why people use them, and what the path forward is to reduce harms and improve benefits that we just can't do because it honestly should be done by the government if only they could be, you know...
Separated from the political problem.
Separated from the political problem.
I mean, I think...
It's a really large, well-funded organization.
My main vision for that isn't actually that big an organization in terms of total budget. I mean, I'd be interested in sort of a $20 million a year kind of international clearinghouse review process, monitoring system. I mean, the European... There's a EMCDDA is a European group that does a bunch of drug monitoring. But they're one of the better groups, but they're still intimately tied with policy and law enforcement. Their main target audience is not the general population who you're trying to improve the way that they act and help them. And so, anyway, I'd like to see an international organization that does approximately what we do and does it better.
No, I think that makes sense. When you have two masters, it's hard to serve them both equally.
Yes.
And then have you ever had sort of legal challenges? Have you ever had sort of official attempts to kind of shut down the site because it's been perceived as a negative source or attempts to kind of freeze accounts or anything?
Nope. We've never had any problem at all.
Great.
We don't become involved in any illegal activity. We don't do anything illegal. We're an information and educational organization, and it appears as though the powers that be
are willing to let
understand that and don't stop us.
I mean,
the beauty of a free society.
Yes. Relatively.
When it comes to ideas and information. And then, so in comparison to other sites, other bulletin board sites like Blue Light and everything, I mean, it seems like, and you get unfiltered, unmoderated submissions, Do you ever just roll your eyes?
Oh, of course. every day.
Every single day. But I roll my eyes at the stuff that gets published by even the best New York Times or whatever. And I mean,
journals.
The scientific journals seem to be, medical research journals seem to be full of a lot of garbage.
What do we get wrong?
There's a lot of politics that enter in. One of my pet peeves is the conflation of abuse and use, the leaning towards or the pressure towards having authors of medical journal articles only be able to describe all use of psychoactive drugs, all unapproved use of psychoactive drugs as abuse is to me an unreasonable direction to go. It's a false conflation, and I think it harms the data.
And when does use become abuse, in your opinion?
I would say that that's a line that can be debated for a long time, but at the point where harm of some sort happens, it would seem like an obvious first requirement.
But there's no life without risk, and so it's not like you can't say that just because one person was harmed driving a car that no one should ever be able to drive a car again.
And then anything else that you read the literature that we should be doing differently?
Well, I mean, I think
how we're doing
the main thing that we would like to see more of from kind of the medical toxicology side is that in our opinion there should be more public data. That we understand some of the reasons why, but sort of friends of ours who are medical toxicologists can't have information that they have access to made public for reasons that are social, political,
financial.
And we would love to see a system by which the poison control centers and things like that actually made data tables available to the public in more raw data format so that they could be reviewed and checked and made available to more people. We think medical toxicologists are the bomb. Poison control centers are the cool.
I think that's the first time anyone has ever said that ever.
That might be true.
They're the cool kids. I mean, this poison control center, I mean, what's cooler than that, right? And so I don't want to complain too much. Doctors who help people who are having some kind of a medical problem with the drugs,
it's important work, and it's great work. And there's a lot of pressures on all sides for all sorts of people, like toxicologists and information providers, and we understand the complexities of the field. But
I would love to see, we run a project called Ecstasy Data, which is the only anonymous testing for street drugs in the United States, which is not saying all that much, but people submit their ecstasy tablets mostly to
a DEA licensed lab.
To a DEA licensed lab that gets tested, and the DEA restricts very tightly what we're allowed to publish and what the lab's allowed to say. But we would love to see more data about the actual contents of the pills and the substances that are going around, partially because one of the main things in sort of the harm reduction work side of things is that one of the main ways that young people specifically and people in general, young people specifically, believe that there's a risk to taking a street drug is to see how polluted the stream of street drugs is. And that I'm not saying that we want to exaggerate that to, try to trick the kiddies not to take their ecstasy, but having only, I think we published 350 results or something like that last year in 2012, and I would love to see that be an order of magnitude larger. I'd love to see something from each city every month, kind of something from the street drug that gets tested to show what it is that's being sold and have that data.
What the person thought they were buying, what they actually ended up buying, and as would likely be the case, because a lot of this would be in cases where people ended up in the hospital, whether that caused a problem.
Right, and that's a big source of adverse effects is people people thinking they're taking something that they're not, taking something else. And then the site is nice in terms of a balance. And then also, I feel like it's nice because it approaches some of the unintended interactions between, somebody on an SSRI or a psychoactive medication and another substance. So it attempts to kind of warn people about possible effects.
I mean, that's one of the things that we get the most requests for and is the hardest information to come by is, what happens if, just the crazy requests we get. If I'm on, if I've had a liver transplant and I'm on transplant drugs and I want to take MDMA, is there going to be a it's like, well, how many people have had encountered that issue before? It's like, well, we've got one. Let us know if you encounter a problem. we'll have one data point.
Exactly.
So there's a lot of interactions and contraindications
that are not recorded, and
you know, people want to know about them, but they're
one of the big areas that I would love to be able to expand into, but we don't currently have the resources to be able to address it in a very comprehensive way, is just dealing with the kind of aging population and the number of different pharmaceuticals that people are on. I think a majority of people over 50 now are taking at least some kind of prescription drug, and that seems particularly complicated if you're dealing with a population of people who are then using unapproved drugs, right, where they haven't been studied by the FDA and they haven't been approved for use with sort of combining your ecstasy with your, you know,
your heart medication.
Yeah, oh, polypharmacy, it scares the heck out of all of us. With an aging population, we're seeing more and more medications being prescribed, and that's definitely happens daily in the emergency department. We see somebody on 7 medications that interact with each other, and those are only the medications that I get on a pharmacy printout
list
in front of you. And then if you, a lot of our listeners are healthcare providers, and I feel like people do this better or worse in terms of approaching a patient that is using substances that you may or may not agree with or prescribe. How do you feel like we should be handling that encounter or doing it better?
Well, I think that seems very individual. From the reports that we get, you know, happily enough, I don't have to go into emergency rooms and
treat people
or be treated. My view of that is that primarily that's kind of an individual kind of doctor basis. Remember, there's a lot of snickering that happens when people are kind of hurt themselves, make stupid choices. You know, not necessarily when they're...
Well, but it's also a really, you know, I recognize, and I don't know what the solution is to the very complex issues of whether or not people do or should or would provide real information to their doctors about what they took if they're experiencing a medical problem because of the legal complications. And so I don't...
It would be nice to separate those issues out.
It would be nice. I mean, people ask us whether they should tell their doctor when they go in, and the answer is, well, it's certainly going to be better for your health, but it's more likely to lead to a legal problem. So I have a hard time conscientiously telling people that the blanket answer is yes, they should always tell their doctor, and that's too bad.
Yeah. This happens all the time, and I have to say that I think the goal of somebody in medical care is always to provide care to the patient, and that's always best with a full knowledge slate. And I mean, I've never reported anything to a legal authority for purely legal reasons, because it's reported to me in confidence,
right.
And it's for the care of the patient. The interface between the law and medicine is an especially sticky and uncomfortable area.
Yeah.
And I mean, sometimes we'll get people who get brought in, and you know, police say they need an alcohol test and they need a drug test, and you know, if it's not good for the patient, it's not usually done. Although the flip side to that also is, I had an elderly couple that came in, and she had tried a marijuana cookie for the first time, and purposefully.
Yep.
And was enjoying it, and her husband brought her in because he really wanted her to kind of be scolded, and like he wanted me to warn her about the extreme danger she had exposed herself to. And there was certainly an amount of snickering kind of behind the counter, because it was hard, and it was like, okay.
Yep. Sure. Careful.
Yeah. I know I'm supposed to be angry, but that's hard.
Yeah.
So we try to approach things gently. One question, though, just because you sort of repeatedly talk about particular age groups who are exploring or maybe not fully realizing the risks of things, experiencing drugs. Do you feel like, I mean, I'm not going to inquire about your families or anything like that. Is there an age that is maybe too young for some of these substances?
Well, I think the answer is yes. You phrase it in a way that we can give a strong affirmative on that. How to draw that line? I mean,
where most of us would probably draw that line is probably older than the average age of initiation. And so what do you do about that? That's a little, you know... And
it's exactly the same question as the sex question. Sort of, well, what age should kids start having sex? You know, it's like...
like, well, everybody thinks that should be 19, except that it's actually 15.
Right.
So what, I mean...
Older than my child, right?
You
know, my kids aren't having sex till they're 30. It's a fairly tricky question, and it's like in terms of sort of the evolution of the species, right, sort of the evolution of culture, sort of like looking towards the future, sort of what can we do better. I don't know how you get kids, younger people, you know, sort of once you kind of head into kind of the teen range at this point, sort of the sort of 12 to 18, pretty much at any age in there, the kids can get access to sex, and they can get access to drugs, and they can get access to alcohol, and what are the right ways to help people make
One of the things that we tell young people sometimes is that there's a lot of life left ahead of you at the age of 15. You don't need to cram it all in at the age of 15. That's right. One thing I can tell you. You don't have to try it all today.
You'll actually enjoy it.
Yeah.
You'll enjoy it more if you wait and go slower. But that's very uncompelling to 14-year-olds.
Incredibly. Well, and the other thing is, I was reviewing something the other day, and part of us providing information is we assume that people have a health motive for their decisions, and there are a certain group of people that don't have a health motive for their decisions who believe they're indestructible, and it can be very challenging to try and appeal. And I feel like, so we've talked about kind of the origins of the site in some respects and how it's evolved a bit and how it's set up and sort of some of the pressures you've experienced and some of the articles you review and kind of talk to you about things that you would like us to be doing. Is there anything that you feel like we've really missed or that you would want to put out there if you could?
The only thing that I thought of slightly earlier was that I'm not sure that we have specifically mentioned that and it might give slightly better context for the site, is that Arrowhead is a nonprofit educational organization approved in the United States as a nonprofit. So we are not quite as fringe and crazy little sub-organization as you might think if you didn't hear that piece of the pie.
So we fill out a lot of...
So does that mean donations are tax-deductible?
It does mean donations are tax-deductible.
And we fill out a lot of paperwork. A lot of accounting.
And then, one tiny thing actually also. So somebody who's looking at your website versus looking at a kind of an unmoderated bulletin board website, what's the danger to the unmoderated bulletin board website?
That you waste a lot of your time.
It'll be really hard to slog through. I think that sites like you mentioned earlier, Blue Light, you know, there's a variety of drugs forum, there's a variety of forum sites like that, which are very useful to us. They are some of the things that we go to, some of the places we go to first to find out what people are doing and what doses they're taking and what the dangers are that people are, health risks that people are experiencing, and they are great for that, but it takes a lot of time to process through them. So there's the possibility of misunderstanding them or reading the wrong set of posts where somebody was just wrong about what they're saying slightly more than hopefully comes through once we've processed it all.
Anytime you can read a conversation online or a discussion where it isn't just a flame war, you're having a good experience. And so there's a lot of really good resources online. Wikipedia is a great place to start, and Drugs Forum and Blue Light are great places if you're looking to spend a lot of time reading about specific people talking about their use and going back and forth in kind of chatty conversation.
And what we try to do is synthesize that a bit and make it so you can read it. It's a little easier.
We're a primary source, where Wikipedia is by definition they don't call themselves a secondary resource. They call themselves a synthesis. There's a specific prohibition on Wikipedia, not always followed, against original research, so that it's not supposed to be the source of original documents. Where Arrowhead and Blue Light and Drug Forum and things like that are actually sources of original documentation.
Thank you both for kind of dedicating yourselves to put information out there, regardless of if you agree or disagree with the use of psychoactive substances. It's definitely a good resource for medical toxicologists and physicians and just people in general to get a sense of what people are using and why they're using and how they're using. Obviously, you two are very passionate about education and have really put a lot of time and energy into that. So I thank you both for doing that and for taking the time to have this interview.
Well, thank you very much for inviting us to join you.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today at Talks Talk. I think that was just a great opportunity to talk to two people who definitely are coming at these issues from a different perspective than I am, different training, but really provided some insight. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. We're hoping to do more interviews like that in the future, as well as continue our discussion of current issues in toxicology. I think that as these new drugs come out, and even we're hearing about some new possible opioid derivatives that are hitting especially New England and coming out of Canada and other places, that keeping your ear to the ground, so to speak, is going to be becoming more and more important, so that we should be opening doors and building bridges rather than breaking them down. And hopefully on future episodes of the show, we'll get a chance to talk to different people about similar issues. I'm definitely excited about some of the episodes we've got coming up. And definitely some of you listeners were kind enough to suggest future guests, and we will try and get a hold of them and talk to them. And we're always open to suggestions for future show ideas. You can send those to us from our website, toxtalk.org, or email us, toxtalk@toxtalk.org, or of course our Facebook or Twitter feed. Tox Talk is a production of the UMass Division of Toxicology and Department of Emergency Medicine. This is Matt Zuckerman signing off.